Welcome back to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show on American Freedom Radio. For the listening displeasure of the intelligence agencies listening in real time. Now, my very special guest who's joining me today is Adam Kokesh, who's a decorated veteran of the war in Iraq and has since become a political activist. And I'd like to welcome him now. Adam, you there?
Yes, I am. Thanks for having me on.
All right, cool, brother. Now, I didn't even know that you got a decoration, bro. What decoration?
Well, I always think it's hilarious when they say that decorated veteran. It's like when you came home, they threw glitter at you or something. And it really is a funny way of referring to how they're able to get so many young men and women to do silly, dangerous, violent things for the sake of a medal being pinned on your chest. And in my case, I have a number of normal military commendations of nothing special, but I also have a Navy commendation medal from my deployment in Iraq, which was in 2004.
What's the Navy's response to a ground conflict? Send in the Marines.
Oh, don't get me started. We'll be here all night telling military jokes.
Have you got some, do you? At least one. That's kind of the spirit of the show.
Marine, what does it stand for? My ass rides in Navy equipment. when I, you know what Army stands for, right? Ain't ready to be Marines yet. When I show a woman at a bar my tattoo and it says USMC and they don't know what that stands for, I usually say it stands for you suck my kumquat. Wait, that's with a K. I need a better you suck my corn on the cob. Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go.
Very nice. I like it. It's tasteful.
keeping it as tasteful as I can and yet still in line with the dictates of military humor, which is not easy, really not easy.
Yeah. Well, it gets to that point where I was just thinking about, I watched a video yesterday that says 101 facts about the CIA. And there was this bit in there where it says that the CIA actually has a bit of a sense of humor. There was this one big incident where they actually produced their own a movie about this incident that was a spoof of the incident, right? And I think these guys have got a sense of humor. And I was thinking, man, maybe that's why my show doesn't get destroyed and I don't get plastered all over the media and demonized and everything like that. Because they really love listening to the lighter side of genocide. Maybe. One can only hope. But other than that, we talk about war and political activism very, very rarely in a human context. Like, you know what I'm saying? There's this barrier because we don't want the reality of what war actually is getting out there into the public consciousness. Because all of a sudden, as soon as you realize, hey, killing normal people for oil or for gold, or for something else, for the United Fruit Company. Doesn't matter what it is. That's what we're doing. We're killing other people so that some people can get rich off of the deaths of the poor who go and fight in their war.
You know, I wish I could make every high school student in America understand that. It's a big part of the satisfaction that I get out of my activism is hearing people by email tell me that because of my work, they didn't join the military or because of my work, they didn't become a police officer. Or, I mean, if that's not close enough to home for you, I have had a couple of people tell me that they didn't become TSA agents because of me. And so I'm very, very happy with that.
Very nice. Actually having it somewhat of an effect.
The way that you say it, you know, I just try to get them to understand it's poor men dying in rich men's wars. And that's always been the case. And I'm glad you cited United Fruit Company because that makes me think of Major General Smedley Butler. One of the great ironies of Major General Smedley Butler is that they actually teach us about him in Marine Corps boot camp as
the second most decorated Marine of all time, two medals of honor, you know, half a dozen Bronze Stars, fought in World War One and all the banana wars, blah, 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 blah. But what they don't teach you is that when he got out of the military, he wrote a book called War is a Racket, in which he describes himself as a high-class muscle man for big business. I mean, it doesn't get any more obvious than that, and yet that's how they whitewash the history for us.
Do you think that maybe... Well, in fact, I was just thinking about Smedley Butler just the other day, and I think Jesse Ventura brought him up on a show. And getting to this point where you've got decorated veterans, like people who actually know, people who were actually there, people who actually have experience telling you the exact opposite thing to what the government is telling you. And that makes your hair stand up on end, and you go, whoa, 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 something really, really scary is going on here. Now, I wanted to get your opinion on the election of Donald Trump, and in particular, the sort of anti-Muslim hysteria that sort of gripped the American public. What do you make of that?
Well, oh, man, that's such a broad, open-ended question. You know, during the campaign season, I used to say that, you know, I just try to see the silver lining in everything. I try to see how everything in terms of those kinds of major political, social events and trends are pointing towards the positive progress of humanity. And, you know, so I would say about Donald Trump, at least so many people who are calling themselves Republicans are looking for something fundamentally different. You know, on the Democratic side, we know that Bernie Sanders really won the primary, and it was stolen from him in so many various ways. So I look at that and I go, wow, you know, people on the left, people who call themselves Democrats, are looking for something fundamentally, philosophically different. And that's exciting. That's a good thing to be celebrated. And on the Donald Trump side, I go, wow, look at what people who call themselves Republicans, they're so desperate for something anti-establishment, they're willing to go with Donald Trump. Of course, now that he's won, we see some other sad, sick phenomena of people who are twisting their positions to match his. And it's, especially to hear people who were previously describing themselves as libertarians, calling themselves alt-right or even outright fascists. And of course, I think those are people who never really understood the message in the first place. But then you look at people like Chris Cantwell and Stefan Molyneux, who I know are both very smart dudes. I consider them both personal friends. And to see them having jumped on the Trump train is very disheartening, because I know they still get the core concept and philosophical ethical grounding of libertarianism based on self-ownership and the non-aggression principle. So when I see that Donald Trump wins on the kind of red meat he's throwing out, what he's throwing out there, I think it's a great sign, not that Donald Trump is president, but that things have shifted, that you win today by doing the kinds of things that Donald Trump did as red meat for genuinely small government people. Of course, he didn't really mean it in terms of being small government overall. That's pretty obvious at this point. You know, he's growing the military. Government's going to grow under Donald Trump, predictably. It's not going to be a significant change in governance. I will say there is one thing that I look at about Donald Trump's campaign and presidency now that I'm very heartened about, that is a great thing that he does deserve some credit for, and that's taking on the mainstream media. However, in terms of what he's been able to do, I would say most of the credit goes to people like you, people who are actually challenging the mainstream media. The credit really goes to people who are helping make that shift happen, to people who are organizing independent media sources, who are promoting independent media sources, who are criticizing the mainstream media and providing real alternatives. And I think Donald Trump's campaign, like with any successful presidential campaign, isn't really changing things so much as capturing existing sentiment. And, you know, I wish that the existing sentiment was closer to a paradigm shift, but I still see that it's getting there, and it's very exciting. Now, you mentioned the anti-Muslim hysteria, and I think you said something about the anti-Mexican hysteria, if not just the anti-immigrant hysteria in general, and I think that's really sad, and I think it is. A lot of people have described Trump's rise to power as being similar to a lot of other dictators' rise to power, even Hitler's, and of course, I don't mean to jump to the Hitler connection. I'm not one of these, oh my God, Trump is Hitler! Like, no. if I'm going to label Trump, like, he's got enough accurate labels. You know, he's a socialist. Why do I need to compare him to Hitler? You know, like, I guess that's one way he does compare well to Hitler.
Hitler was a national socialist. So.
It really is appropriate. But, you know, Donald Trump is a socialist in the sense that he wants, massive socialization of many economic functions to be performed within government. And, you know, that doesn't mean that, like, you know, by that definition, yeah, Ronald Reagan was a socialist too. Yeah, that's kind of the point of describing things by their proper terms. So, like I said, I wish there was something more fundamentally toward, you know, paradigm shifting about what Donald Trump is doing. But that reactionaryism that comes out of that manifests itself as that anti-other xenophobic sentiment.
Speaking of which,
I think that's sort of a consequence of, like it was with Hitler after World War I, the psychological state of the country and a certain insecurity that leads people to fear outsiders.
Now, this might harken back for you, reading off your Wikipedia page here in October 2007 on George Washington University campus, you put up mock posters. The Islamophobic, what was it? Islamofascism Awareness Week.
Yeah.
Now, here's the thing. I had this realization back then, okay, because you sort of woke up and got into doing the truth and activism at exactly the same I did, that 2007-2008 break. And I don't know about you, bro, but I see the exact same issues that woke us up then suddenly being repeated now, exactly 8 years later. Do you notice that? The exact same issues we were dealing with back then have all of a sudden come full circle. All the WikiLeaks that came out back then have now happened again. All the Islamophobia that was happening back then is now happening again, you know, that kind of thing. And all the hype for a new president, you know, the Obama, the hope, the change, it's happening again.
Yeah.
And people don't see it.
Yeah, that's a really interesting comparison. I hadn't considered that, but it makes me think of, you know, Tom Sawyer, Huckleberry, Mark Twain. Mark Twain said, you know, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes, or something to that effect. And I think that's a brilliant perspective on history, because, like you said, what we see is a kind of rhyming pattern here. I would say it's more in the swing of the pendulum going from left to right, that when the right is ascendant, it's when you have this kind of atmosphere and this anti-Islam hysteria or this xenophobia. And I'd like to, if you remember, I mean, back in 2007, 2008, this was in the Bush years. This was when, you know, the war in Iraq was still a relevant question. And, you know, we kind of won the debate as Iraq Veterans Against the War as to whether or not the war was a good idea. But there was still the ongoing occupations. And, I mean, the great irony of this is that Barack Obama tried to keep troops in Iraq longer than they would have been there under the Bush plan. But I think when I say, you know, in this context, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. To me, that's just reassuring that while it's kind of a spiral, you know, an upward spiral or a corkscrew. And so when you get to the same rotational point, it might seem like it's rhyming, but we've progressed. And as much as I'm concerned for Donald Trump's foreign policy, I don't think he's going to be able to get away with what people used to get away with. I think this is the course of human progress, and this is so important to understanding how we move past this government paradigm, is that we look at how humanity moves forward. And we are living in the most peaceful times in human history right now. I mean, if you watch the news, you might not know, but we are actually less likely today than ever before to be subject to violence at the hands of a human being or die in armed conflict. That is an amazing thing to step back and appreciate when you understand freedom properly as a state of universal nonviolence. If someone is being violent, someone's freedom is being violated. You know, it's not that hard to understand. So I'm encouraged by this, because I don't think that, as bad as Trump's foreign policy could be, I'm going to keep my fingers crossed, he's not going to come up with anything as destructive as the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan. No. I should say invasions and ongoing occupations.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I was thinking about the after 9/11, it happened. What was it? A year, two years after that, the Iraq invasion commenced. No evidence, no nothing. Just roll right in, and mainstream media is on side. And now we have a slightly different dynamic whereby they can't do that again because the mainstream media is simply not on Trump's side, are they? They seem to be attacking him left, right, and centre. And one part of me says, that's interesting. That gives him some legitimacy in my eyes. And then the other part of me thinks, what if it's just a game to convince people that he's anti-establishment when he's really actually working with them and nothing the press is actually going to do with him will damage him politically, really, do anything other than give him free airtime?
Or keep him sort of stuck from being able to do anything at all other than keep the machine running. And you know what? I'm so glad that you mentioned that because a lot of people never get past that first level of analysis. They never get past that reaction. You know, and I think about Milo Yiannopoulos and his recent challenges and the way that he's come out on top with that and the great PR that he's gotten because of it. You know, what they attack, like, the idea that when government censors something, they're drawing attention to it. You know, when you tell a child, don't smoke cigarettes, you just introduce the idea to them, hey, smoke cigarettes. Maybe they had no idea what it was before that. And I think it's the same thing with who they openly attack. Like, they want them to be the loyal opposition. This is part of the left-right shell game, the duopoly of the Democrats and Republicans. And if the media is controlled by leftists, then they want the loyal opposition. They love Trump. Like, would they rather it be like Rand Paul? If it was Rand Paul, you know, he wouldn't have won in the first place, and he didn't win in part because he didn't get the media attention. And part of that was because, I'm not being conspiratorial minded at all here. I'm putting pieces together of stuff that we see in real life. You know, when it came out, the Podesta emails with Hillary Clinton's campaign, they were actually saying that they wanted Ted Cruz, Ben Carson, or Donald Trump to be the candidate. And they got Donald Trump, who was, I think their first choice, because he's really a Democrat, you know? It doesn't get any more obvious than this. Former big government New York Democrat posing as a Republican, he wins the nomination because he gets massive media attention during the campaign. Duh, what do you think is going on here? You know, they know how this system works. They know that if they attack something in a certain way, they're just calling attention to it. That's what they did with Donald Trump. I think that's more or less what they're doing now, although there is a real competition going on, and Donald Trump is skewing the odds in favor of independent media for the long run, but, you know, not really in any kind of fundamental shifting way. He is part of the game. He's part of this, you know, black hat, white hat. We're gonna put on a show for you, or as Frank Zappa described it, the American politics is the entertainment wing of the military-industrial complex.
Or who else was it said that politics is show business for ugly people?
Yeah, no, Hollywood, or Washington is Hollywood for ugly people.
Yeah. It's just like, oh, bro, man, I bet you a hell of a lot of senators have to pop a few more Starburst and Prozac after hearing that one. Now, we got this concept now in America, like this make America great again sort of thing. And I was just like, whoa, hold on a second. Make America great again? Let's run back the history. Let's just roll right back. Okay, Dutch East India Trading Company comes in. They're immigrants, and they come in and they exterminate the local population, and then set up their own thing because they don't want to pay taxes to the king on all of the land that they stole and all the slaves that they got. Okay, sweet as. We're now independent. We're now free. Oh, okay. Well, you're going to land for that. Oh, you've got a whole bunch of rights and everything like that, do you? right. And what's interesting to me is, somebody made this point the other day, is that the only institution, the only business that it was even mentioned in the Constitution was the press. Right? Because even those people knew that once the press has been taken over by the corporations or by the government or whomever, there is no freedom. None. If you can't say the truth, and if you can't express that truth and tell it to people and put it across to people in a publication of some description where more than one person can participate at a time, that is the end of your freedom.
Yeah.
And I'm starting to think that that's largely what we're fighting for here. I mean, is that not the cornerstone of any kind of free society? And is this perhaps one of the things that should be indeed the priority of anybody who's actually fighting for freedom in this day and age? It's not necessarily the military. It's not necessarily the government that is taking away your freedoms. It's the mainstream media that is owned by the military-industrial complex that is constantly brainwashing people into giving up their own power.
Man, that's such a big question. I don't know. I think you're right in pointing out the fundamental nature of the First Amendment and freedom of the press, and that if you don't have that, everything else goes away. But now, I mean, I don't even try to think of it in those terms. It's in the age of the internet, when you say the mainstream media lies, it just has no, it doesn't come with the same threat that it did in the past. And we've never really, I'd like to say that in America that freedom of speech has been generally respected. And like, you know, I mean, I've been to jail for making a YouTube video. So, you know, I know, you know, and I've dealt with all kinds of censorship. And if I may go back for a second, like, it's not the ones that they're censoring going, here, we're censoring these, don't smoke cigarettes. It's the ones that you never hear about, you know, like myself, or, you know, who just get kept out, like my book being banned in prisons, who are the ones that are really challenging the status quo, who the mainstream media is never going to attack unless they absolutely have to. And it's not going to look like the way Donald Trump was attacked. So, free, you know, we, generally speaking, though, it's been respected in America. And I think that's one thing that the founders did get really right that has created a sense of respect for freedom of speech in American culture that really has been pretty dominant. I'd like to say that you know the American people did something more with it, you know, or were more aware as a result. But I think we see that there's more to it than that, Vinny. You know, it's not just freedom of the speech will result in a free society. You know, that freedom of speech has to be used to maintain an understanding of freedom. And some people would say that, you know, that if you look at the Constitution, Declaration of Independence, Americans used to have a greater understanding of freedom. You know, I don't know if that's true. Back then, the, you know, literate portion of society was a lot smaller. So when I use that phrasing, you know, people, we got to maintain our culture of liberty or maintain our understanding of it. I don't know if that's really the case. So I wouldn't even say that it's about freedom of the press as more as of the paradigm. Alexis de Tocqueville in 1831, when he wrote Democracy in America, said, in a democracy, a people will get the government they deserve. I think that's true about all cultures, all countries across all of time, with all governments, is that people will get the government they deserve. It's the paradigm that results in that. If people demand freedom, there won't be government. And we haven't really hit that point yet, but we're rapidly approaching it because people are waking up faster and faster because of the internet, which really is when it comes down to it. I mean, yeah, they can nibble around the edges. They can skew things. And I mean, I can tell you from like firsthand experience, all the different ways that I've been messed with on YouTube and on social media. But, you know, ultimately, it's the great information equalizer. The truth is out there. We now all have the truth button one click away. You smell something fishy in the mainstream media, you know, Google that shit. It's not that hard. It's right there. Everybody's got access to it. So they can slow things down. But, you know, right now, this is the real shift. I think Donald Trump's phenomena with the media is almost a late reaction to the internet. And it's kind of about time that we had a president who was able to capitalize on that more directly. I mean, can you imagine if it was 8 years prior and Barack Obama was calling out the media for being pro-war around George Bush and really taking on the media corruption that way? He could have, but at that point, it wasn't the same hot button issue that it was able to be as a positive thing for Donald Trump to fit with his campaign narrative.
I wonder if there's, again, you talk about this this concept of a paradigm shift where things actually realistically change on, you know, from the ground up. And it's that grassroots movement, I think, is usually the thing that actually genuinely changes societies throughout the course of history. Grassroots movement. Change never comes from the top down. And that's why I was, I don't know, I guess I was really angry, I think, because as soon as Donald announced who his cabinet was, and it's like Trilateral Commission, Council on Foreign Relations, yeah. Freemasons, Goldman Sachs, you know, and it's like, this is like, if you wanted to continue the New World Order agenda, these are who you pick.
Yeah, yeah.
And I got so angry about that because it didn't seem that anybody else in the alternative media was calling that out. You know?
Well, when you say no one else in the alternative media, I mean, you know, there's... Are you complaining about Alex Jones having gone the way of Donald Trump as well?
Well, that was one of my, that was one of the sticking issues for me, because, like, I think... I saw this one video, and he says, he's talking to the camera, Donald Trump is absolutely anti-establishment. He's 100% trustworthy. And I was just like, you've lost objectivity. Boom, gone. Just shh.
Yeah.
And it was like pouring gasoline on your on your resume, you know?
Yeah, and if Alex Jones had not gone in for Trump the way that he had, he'd be able to be calling him out right now. And his is really the kind of voice that we need. His perspective and his analysis really calling out all the corruptions around or with the Trump presidency.
Mm. But if he starts doing that now, won't everybody just go, ah, you told us something different? And I saw this sort of, what was it? I think he was interviewing Jesse Ventura, and Jesse Ventura was very much saying a lot of the things that I was thinking. Sure, I'll give him a chance, but I'm not buying into it, because he says one thing one day and one thing the next, and they're complete opposites, right? So you can't do it. And I watched this video yesterday, 101 Facts About the CIA, and the very first part of the video was about the OSS and which was the precursor to the CIA, obviously, and what their initial jobs actually were. And 90% of it was propaganda. And there's two elements behind propaganda about what you're supposed to actually do with it. Number one is to either convince your enemy of something that is untrue, to undermine your enemy's reputation, and if you can't achieve that, to simply sow confusion so that a reasonable defense cannot be mounted against your propaganda. And then I was just sitting there going, whoa, I'm starting to see that everywhere I look now. You know, Operation Mockingbird and all of that kind of thing. And when I think it was Pete Santilli got hacked, and it turned out that a leak came out of a fax that he sent to the FBI demanding that they protect him from me and Suzanne Posel, who were exposing him and what he did to the Truckers' Ride for the Constitution, stole their Facebook page with 250,000 likes and renamed it Guerrilla Media Network page with 250,000 likes, took $50,000 out of their PayPal and never seen again kind of thing. It's just like, whoa. How infiltrated is the media? We know that. But how infiltrated is the alternative media? And that was the thing that really started to get my goat. It's like, oh my God, maybe we're tearing each other apart for good reason. Maybe truth or infighting exists for a good reason, because there are real truthers and not real truthers.
Man, you know, I'm glad you brought that up, because it's something that I grapple with a lot. You know, I as of... wow, geez, I missed it. It was 3 days ago. 3 days ago, I had my 10-year anniversary of full-time activism. And, I mean, do you mind if I go on a bit of a tangent with this, with Iraq Veterans Against the War and Vietnam Veterans Against the War?
That's kind of what this show's for.
All right, cool. Because, you know, when I got involved with activism full-time, it was first with Iraq Veterans Against the War. I don't know if you can see that there, my tattoo. That mirrors my Marine Corps tattoo on the other arm.
You have to turn on your webcam for that.
Oh, it's on. It's been on.
Is it? Doesn't look like it.
I mean, I got it on display here.
Nope, doesn't look like it. I've just stopped sharing my screen, so why don't you try turning it off and then turning it on again?
Sure. There you go. Anyway, so when I got involved with activism full-time, it was first with Iraq Veterans Against the War, and we very much learned from our predecessors in Vietnam Veterans Against the War, and it was like Iraq in so many ways, even in the anti-war movement, was an echo of the war in Vietnam. And the guy that I was being compared to was a man named Scott Camille, and I feel like my entire experience as an activist and in the military was like a, you know, an echo of his, because he did two tours in Vietnam. He was shot. He killed a lot of people himself, and he came back very gung-ho and proud about the war and went to an anti-war demonstration with Jane Fonda and a bunch of other anti-war Vietnam veteran activists. And was like, I'm going to tell them off. I'm going to tell them how it is. I'm going to tell them how righteous and just the war in Vietnam is. And he came out going, oh, crap, they're right. And, you know, for me, it was that I was against the war before the war. I went to the Day of Student Walkouts in February of 2013, before 2003, excuse me, way back before the invasion. And then volunteered to go because I was, you know, against the invasion but pro-occupation. I thought it was responsible foreign policy. I thought it was like it was cleaning up our mess or something. But, you know, I went. I did one tour. I got shot at. I saw some people die. But my experience was, a fraction of what Scott's was. But we both became very prominent national figures in the anti-war movement very quickly. Because we were both willing, when we started, to commit full-time to activism. We were willing to get arrested. You know, I've been arrested in my activism over 36 times now. And most of those were with Iraq Veterans Against the War. So when the FBI sent an attractive young female agent to seduce him, she introduced him to heroin. And then introduced him to two other agents who were undercover who he was supposed to go and buy heroin with. And they were setting him up. It was an entrapment gambit. And when he figured this out, he was in the passenger seat, the front passenger seat of a car, with one of them driving and one of them behind him. And they shot him in the back when he tried to get out of the car when he figured out what was going on. And as you can imagine, when this went to trial, in this case, I guess it was a bit of a surprise. He got somewhat of a fair trial where the judge concluded that the agents involved should be tried for attempted murder. But what's not surprising is that what happened instead is that they got promoted. So obviously this was something that the government, the higher-ups within the FBI supported. You're probably well aware of COINTELPRO and all the various things that the FBI did to disrupt activist movements in the 60s and 70s. But you have to think then, how has that evolved to today? What are they doing today that might be similar or, say, an evolution of those tactics of disruption within organizations that are challenging the government's power, challenging militarism, challenging specific wars especially? And I never saw anyone, I've yet to find someone or in all of my 10 years see someone who I can say, that guy was a plant, you know. That was definitely an agent. That guy was not here for the legitimate reasons that he said he was. But I've seen enough fishy stuff around that to know that it's not like the government all of a sudden went, oh, yeah, let's be hands off. Let's let all these activists do their thing uninterrupted. And what occurred to me is that for an organization like Iraq Veterans Against the War, and I'm trying to connect this to what you said about infiltration, about independent media, because it's really part of the same group of anti-government forces that the government would try to disrupt. Although I will say, there are two modern examples that we know of that come to mind. I'm sure there are lots more if you could look at these. But in the anti-war days in 2004, 2005, when things were first heating up around Bush, there was a police officer, you know, young, fit dude with a buzz haircut, going into one of these Grannies for Peace meetings where it was like, you know, a bunch of old ladies and then this one young dude going like, yes, I'm here to protest the war. And, you know, he was exposed. It was kind of obvious. And then we've seen cops in D.C. who were caught on Facebook by having their pictures published who had infiltrated the Occupy movement. And regardless whether or not you like the Occupy movement, you got to respect they were legitimately challenging, if not government power, government-sponsored corporate power, and that's certainly something that would
at the Occupy movement here in New Zealand, which I did more videos than anybody else did, even more than their own media team. the Occupy movement was like a complete protest of everything that was wrong, right? And that's why people didn't get it, because they didn't realize how much was wrong.
Yeah, wow. Well, so we know that that's happened. And what occurred to me is that if you were trying to disrupt Iraq Veterans Against the War as an organization, you wouldn't have to infiltrate directly. And it would have been easy because they could have recruited some pro-military person out of the military who would have all the perfect credentials to say, yeah, I'm an anti-war veteran. But I don't think they did that. I mean, I if they did, it was for observational purposes, and they kept anybody doing that kind of low profile. I don't want to say that didn't happen, obviously, but what I think did happen, and now this is truly speculation, but I'm going to bring it back to your question. I'm going to make a really important point about what the takeaway from all this is, and it's that they could have disrupted us by just being the guy on the park bench that the one crazy person on the board of directors listens to. And I was on the board of directors of IVW saying, hey, How come that guy Adam gets to give the speeches? How come he's the one getting all this media coverage? Shouldn't it be you? You know, prodding and kind of provoking that kind of interpersonal conflict within an organization was enough to, I think, keep Iraq. I think, you know, a lot of that infighting that happened in Iraq Veterans Against the War really kept us from achieving our potential as an organization. I think we could have had a much greater effect. I think we could have had a much longer lasting effect in the realms of counter recruiting, as we mentioned earlier, and on militarism as a whole. But we didn't, because there was a lot of infighting in the organization, and it was very sad that we often got derailed from productive work because of that. So I have to wonder, with independent media, what would they be doing similarly to disrupt in a way that's completely undetectable? And, you know, I think we got to judge people by their fruits, really. You know, what are they producing? You know, and I'm not, you know, I've always considered myself friends with Pete Santilli. I don't know, maybe you can fill me in on what, you know, you've experienced with him in that sense. But like, I look at, you know, even Alex Jones, some people would say he's controlled opposition because he got his start in mainstream radio, and that the people behind 9/11 would want someone loud and crazy to be representing that movement. And so they let Alex Jones get successful on mainstream terrestrial radio. But he's not a plant. I mean, that's a ridiculous idea that, like, Alex Jones is a plant or that he's an agent. I mean, that really is ridiculous.
Yeah, I didn't think so either.
Because, you know, how could it be the government's plan? We're going to wake up thousands of people to at least this level of being woke. And then, you know, lead them astray with Donald Trump. Like, I don't think that serves their purpose. You know, although, gee, Alex Jones going Donald Trump does make me wonder a little bit. But, you know, I think there are enough people who, you know, like yourself, you know, and I this is one place where I will say, yes, I stand behind my resume. It speaks for me 100% that I've been doing this for 10 years. I went to jail. I wrote the book on freedom. You know, I've woken up thousands of people. You know, I can look at someone who's done that kind of work, who's made that kind of commitment, and say, you know, without question, this is a dude who's here for the right reasons. And the big takeaway that I would want to impress upon you and your audience, and maybe this is the next place to take the conversation, is that When you suspect that someone is a plant or an infiltrator or an agent of some kind, then that's something that really needs to be drawn, you know, a lot of attention to. But more importantly, it doesn't matter if someone is an agent or not. If they're always causing drama, if they're not contributing productively to the cause in some way by their own statements, if they're really just taking down other people, then it doesn't matter if they're a plant or not. They're someone who you need to disassociate from, but also not be distracted by. Stay focused on doing what you're doing. to make the world a better place, because that might be the whole thing that they have to do to take us down or minimize our effectiveness and keep government going for another couple of generations, is to get us fighting amongst ourselves when we don't need to. You know, we can be strong individuals. We don't need to be in some kind of hierarchy or organization. And, you know, I'm not an anti-hierarchy, you know, anarchist. I'm all for voluntary hierarchies and, you know, cooperatives and companies and major businesses. But in this particular struggle that we're engaged in a way, we just have to stay focused on what we're doing as individuals and say, I'm doing my part to make the world a better place. I'm not going to be brought down. I'm not going to be distracted.
Somebody was telling me before, well, let me just tell you a little bit about Pete Santilli. So I worked with him on my project called Guerrilla Media. Unbeknownst to me, a month before we had that conversation, he bought guerrillamedianetwork.com as a domain name. All right, and that was at the time that he joined this network. And then the day after, he got all this information about how to run Guerrilla Media, what it is, and the whole system behind it. He then got fired off our network by calling in a fellow host radio show and abusing them. And then he took Guerrilla Media Network live and then cut me out of my own project, right? And it was just like, man, this is a really bad dude. And my friend Suzanne Posel was working with him for over a year without even suspecting what he was and what he was doing and that kind of thing. So it's just like, if the world's run by psychopaths, and quite frankly, I think that it is, because if you have a look at how psychopaths run things, you realize that it's identical to how the government and how law institutions, how the media and how the military and how everything works, more or less. If it's an institution of great size with great power and great money, it's run by a psychopath in general. It's not absolutely everything watertight like that, but in general, that's kind of how it sort of works. Now, in the talk radio field, narcissism is more or less a requirement. So I looked up all these symptoms of narcissism, and I found out that there's these two things that are very not well known about narcissism. Number one is self-aware narcissists, somebody who knows that they're a narcissist. And in most cases, they think that they're superior to other people. And also benign narcissists, somebody who's got fused neural pathways, so they can't experience life and love as normal other people do, only an approximation for it, but they're not actually evil. They still have creativity. They still have love, but they're also very when they get criticized, it really hurts, and they often have these things called narcissistic rage. So you get this big anger attack, right? And I was just like, whoa. There's so many things that just sort of like describe my personality and so many personalities of nearly everybody in the talk radio circuit. And I've started to believe that it's indeed one of the requirements is that you have a personality disorder in order to be a talk radio show host.
Yeah, to a certain degree, I mean, I'd like to take credit for then falling over into this backwards. I didn't plan on going this way, although I'm not a radio. Like, see, I gave it up. I think that's the greatest proof I'm not a narcissist. But I do have my tendencies. I understand that, and it's important to be aware of. I think that kind of mental health analysis is a really important way of looking at this, and especially for self-awareness for people who are like this. But, yeah, I mean, who are you to be like, yeah, people should listen to me talk for hours? Like, yeah, the premise of that, you know, like there has to be something driving that is somewhat unhealthy, you know, and I used to do, you know, the one thing I don't like about that analysis is the labeling part, you know, that like you're either a narcissist or you're not, because it exists on an entire spectrum. And I don't think it's really, you know, when you look at those sort of secondary personality features and traits, I don't think you're looking at someone's core personality. Like I can say that, you know, when I was doing a 3-hour daily podcast and 20 minutes of separate video per day for my YouTube channel, plus other special event videos, like I was so caught up in what I was doing. You know, I had a bunch of interns working for me. I had some staff back then. I have staff now, too, but for the presidential campaign and for my nonprofit at this point. But, you know, when I had staff around me for the radio show, or for the podcast, and for my radio show before that, and for the TV show before that, it's sort of like I'm surrounded by people whose job it is to amplify my voice because I'm so special. you know, and it creates this, you know, a different mentality. And then, you know, when something screws up, you know, who's the Fox? You know, fuck it, we'll do it live. Bill O'Reilly.
O'Reilly, you know?
You know, something goes wrong and it's that narcissistic rage because what, all of a sudden all these people aren't existing to support me and amplify my voice. What's wrong? I think it's important to recognize that. Cause like you could have analyzed me as more narcissistic when I had a show than I have been since then, you know, not just on like the superficial behavior levels, but even, excuse me, in my state of mind.
Mm.
And,
well, when I discovered that I was a bit of a narcissist, the first thing I did was I called up a friend of mine who's an expert in psychopaths, and I was like, bro, what will I do? You know, and he goes, no, don't worry, bro, you're a benign narcissist, you're not bad, you know? It's just like this this thing, it's a personality disorder, and the interesting thing about personality disorders is that they're just like normal people. People with personality disorders are normal people. It's a wide variation. It's just when you get to the really bad end of the spectrum, away from benign and onto malignant, that you start to get really bad people who are in it for the wrong reasons. Like, for example, two of the best examples of benign narcissists is Bruce Lee and Muhammad Ali. You have a look at their personalities, you'll have a look at how they talk to people, how they act, and their achievements in life and everything like that. It's typical of a narcissist because when you've got, it's an overinflated ego. So essentially your image of yourself isn't internalized like most people. When your neural pathways fuse shut because you haven't had enough love or whatever, your ego becomes externalized. And that's why really brilliant people are often narcissistic because they have to achieve something in life almost every single day of their life and achieve something that they're proud of just to feel whole.
That's funny. I didn't know they put in that personality thing on my Wikipedia page. I'm looking at it now since you got it pulled up. It's funny. The thing about stealing credit, I mean, it's funny. This is going to come off my page because this is like being one of the things that was on my page when I was with Iraq Veterans Against the War. They said I was affiliated with Al Qaeda. Yeah, because I want the American troops out of Iraq, I must be affiliated with Al Qaeda. The person who wrote that has really discredited himself since then. And it's funny, the thing about stealing credit was a joke that I used to make about myself not stealing credit. But the Libertarian Party nomination for president for 2020 campaign is actually a really amazing thing that's going on right now that people are signing up for. People are joining us on the forums at thefreedomline.com. We're going on a kickoff tour this fall, and I won't have that same manager with me, that's for sure. And he was a tour manager who really came on to be a driver and an assistant on the tour. But that's all in the past at this point. People are really excited about this, that we could actually win the LP nomination for 2020 on the platform of a peaceful, orderly dissolution of the entire United States federal government. That's something, like you talk about the paradigm shift. A lot of people have told me that this platform is really only viable when there's a major shakeup of the system, when people are hit economically, when, you know, the dollar starts to collapse or certain national systems or federal government programs start to fail. And, you know, I'm not one of these doomsdayer types, but I think in that sense, we are coming to a critical point in the paradigm shift that people are going, hey, wait a second, like this government thing really isn't good for my personal financial security in so many ways. And yeah, if we got government down to the state level from the federal level, we'd all be a lot better off in this country.
What do you think is actually going to happen within the next 4 years or so? Do you think Trump will wind up getting reelected? Or in fact, no. I'm going to turn that back around, actually, because I hate it when people predict the future and say, "Oh, this is going to happen or that's going to happen." It pisses me off, actually. I don't know why I asked that question, bro. Sorry about that. Okay, one last thing. I need you to give me a bit of a breakdown, just your actual awakening. Okay, we've got maybe five minutes left in the broadcast. I want to know what actually made you stop wanting to be as an occupation force and become a full-time activist? What was the incident?
Well, you know, I think when we try to mythologize our waking up, we do ourselves a great disservice because it makes it harder for us to wake other people up. So I don't want to try to I want to, as briefly as I can, include as much intellectual nuance and integrity to the narrative of waking up for me, because I have to start with who I was as a child, as a generally anti-authoritarian person, just, you know, being raised by parents who had a healthy disdain for authority, and yet being insecure enough to being led to want to join the Marine Corps, to, you know, that, I really wanting that validation that came with that militarism and, you know, that stamp of approval from government. Ah, he's a United States Marine now. And I actually would describe myself as a libertarian in high school, but I didn't really know what it meant. And it took me another 10 years, you know, of going to Iraq and finding out the hard way the truth about militarism and war, that being a libertarian was more about principle than politics, and about self-ownership and the non-aggression principle, rather than being socially liberal and fiscally conservative. So I went to Iraq, realized the war itself was a bad idea, even though at that point I volunteered to go back. I got in trouble for bringing a pistol back the first time when I tried to go back the second time, which is really kind of funny, because if it wasn't for that, I would not have woken up. I mean, I'm pretty slow, you know. I'm kind of a thick dude. It takes me a long time. You know, I got to figure stuff out and have absolute confidence in it before incorporating it in my worldview and really embracing it properly. So I got back from Iraq in 2004, got out of the military after getting busted down from sergeant to corporal November 30, 2006. So when I got out, I was just disgruntled enough. They had made it personal for me to really start questioning everything. And so when I joined Iraq Veterans Against the War, it wasn't planned. I was in Washington, D.C. to get a master's in political management at George Washington University and fell backwards into full-time activism with IVAW. So that was, you know, a major thing for me, because it led me to being surrounded by leftists who I knew were well-intentioned people who were genuinely anti-war. And I was like, well, I'm a libertarian. I know I'm right about everything. I just have to prove it. And that led me to get to a point of much greater philosophical grounding in my understanding of the message. And that was a really critical turning point for me at that juncture, that led me to a deeper understanding of libertarianism. But then I was endorsed by Ron Paul in 2009 to run for Congress in New Mexico in the 2010 race. And it was while I was running for office in New Mexico, I read Ethics of Liberty by Murray Rothbard. And that's what did it for me. That got me to the bottom of the rabbit hole politically, of understanding that government is fundamentally unethical, illegitimate, and should be abolished as soon as possible for the sake of humanity.
All right. Eloquent in its brevity. Adam Kokesh, ladies and gentlemen, you're not doing Adam versus the man anymore, but it's Adam Kokesh. He's got a YouTube channel there, ladies and gentlemen, and you can definitely check that out, youtube.com/user/AdamKokesh. And he's wearing a nice cowboy hat there with a Freedom 2020 as the logo for the presidential race upcoming. Thank you very much for tuning in, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you very much, Adam, for sharing your time with us here today.
My pleasure, brother.
All right, we'll see you again sometime, folks.